I immediately thought of my wife, Libby, and thought, see, I've got to get a hold of her, contact her. And that was my first thought. I already said, look, I'm coming home. And the event hadn't even been officially cancelled then. And she wasn't telling me, she was sort of like pleading with me to come home. I said, don't worry, it's just a bike ride. I'm coming home.
This is Explore by the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
I got here eventually, Hannah. It doesn't always have to be a race. You just have to turn the pedals one rev at a time until you reach your destination. That's what cycling's all about.
Yeah, okay. Just keep telling yourself that.
Science in sport. Fueled by science.
Well, this is the second episode of Explore by the Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney and I'm with Hannah Troup. Hello, Hannah. How are you?
A little bit cold. When you cycle that slowly, it doesn't help keep you warm, I'm afraid to say, Lionel.
There's nothing to stop you sprinting off into the distance, turning round in the road and coming back to join me, you know. We're on a social ride.
Yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, the second half of this episode of Explore is with the self-styled slow cyclist. Hannah, do you know who that is?
I don't, but I hope you're going to tell me, Lionel.
I am. His name is Ollie Broom, and he gave up his job in the City of London in 2009 and decided to cycle all the way to Australia to watch the Ashes cricket, as you do. It took him 412 days to ride to Brisbane, and he wrote a very entertaining book about his journey.
I did the UK. I did one night in France where I got my bike lights stolen. I moved into Belgium, cycled through Luxembourg, Germany, Austria, Hungary. From Hungary, I went into Serbia, Bulgaria, Turkey, down through Syria. Wouldn't want to do that these days. Jordan, Egypt. From Sudan, I flew across to India, Bangladesh, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, caught a boat to Australia, cycled across Australia. That's 23 countries. I think I managed to play cricket in 19 of them.
This series of Explore is sponsored by The Economist, and we're very grateful to have their support. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and even sport. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. And if you'd like a free print copy of The Economist and you're in the UK, text the word cycle to 78070. Now, Hannah, you've been reading The Economist this week. What has caught your eye?
So the article that's caught my eye this week is one called Click to Download Teacher. And the opening line of the article says, books will soon be obsolete in schools, which is apparently what Thomas Edison had said in 1913. Obviously, we know that that's not the case. Books are still very much in schools. But the thing that really resonated with me was the fact that I'm actually learning French online at the moment via Skype. My tutor is in Portugal. I'm in London and we have a bi-weekly Skype lesson. And so the thing about this article is it's talking about how technology can help children in poorer countries and bring the level of their education up. Because at the moment, they are finding it difficulty with good enough qualified teachers to actually teach, or actually the teachers turning up in general. It's really amazing how they're talking about how this can, it's not necessarily a panacea for it all, but it actually is going to help increase the educational level of poorer countries and has a larger effect in poorer countries than what it does actually in richer countries.
Yeah, Africa's electrifying apace, according to the article. And in Kenya, electricity coverage has gone up from 27% to 55% of households in just 3 years. But they don't even need to be on the electric grid, and they certainly don't need to be on the internet, because the devices can be taken to where there is a connection to upload or download information, lesson plans, I guess, and that keeps the cost down as well. So a really interesting way to kind of spread learning. How are the French lessons going, Hannah?
I can't believe you put me on the spot like this. I'm not going to fall for that one.
Too easy. Well, if you'd like to get a free print copy of The Economist, just text the word cycle, that's C-Y-C-L-E, to 78070. Should we get on with the show, Hannah? Do some exploring.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Well, before we hear from the man who rode to Australia slowly, let's hear from someone who rode across Australia, an Australian himself, Rupert Guinness. Rupert is one of the characters of the Tour de France press room. You can't fail to spot him. He wears a different Hawaiian shirt every day. He's been covering the Tour and European cycling since 1987. So he's been coming over for 30 and a bit years, covering pro racing. One of the warmest characters of the press room, one of the most loved. Well, Hannah, you were at the tour this July. Did you manage to meet Rupert?
I didn't, unfortunately. I thought I was going to be able to spot that Hawaiian shirt across the press room at some point, but unfortunately our paths didn't cross this year. But everyone who I speak to, like you said, speaks of him very highly. And I remember listening to him on another podcast this year about him talking quite poignantly, actually, about Fabio Casatelli's death. That was back in the 90s. And and the way he's able to talk you through sort of emotional events is quite incredible. So I'm looking forward to listening to him about this.
Yeah, Rupert's covered 30 years of the Tour de France and all of the significant stories that have happened during that period. And when I heard that he was going to tackle the Indian Pacific Wheel Race, I hope he doesn't take offence at this, but I was sceptical whether he'd be able to do it, because riding across the whole of Australia is quite a significant undertaking. He lined up for the Indian Pacific Wheel Race, or IndyPac as they call it, in March 2017. The event goes from Fremantle near Perth in Western Australia, and it finishes in the shadow of the Sydney Opera House. Rupert lives in Sydney, so in a way he was always riding home. It's 5,470 kilometres. It takes the riders through the deepest of the deep outback, the Nullarbor Plain, which itself is 1,000 kilometres. And, the March 2017 IndyPac, of course, ended in tragedy because it was the race in which Mike Hall was killed. And Rupert stopped when he heard the news and the event was officially cancelled. And he went back home and he talked very poignantly about the moment that he heard that Mike Hall had died. And the journey, the quest to ride across Australia was something that you know, he hadn't quite scratched the itch. And so when the opportunity came up for him to set off again some months later, he took that opportunity and he completed the ride. It took him 27 days, 2 hours and 15 minutes. He averaged a mind-boggling 202 kilometres a day. I'm not sure. Well, that's quite a lot for nearly a month of riding, isn't it?
Yeah, that's crazy, managing to be able to do that day in, day out. The level of fatigue you must feel towards the end, I can't even imagine.
But I've known Rupert a long time and he's a very easygoing kind of guy. The Hawaiian shirts give us, as I say, give that kind of the warm exterior. And I really wasn't prepared for the story he was going to tell me. It was a voyage of discovery and self-discovery for him. And, well, we'll listen to what Rupert says about his journey across Australia now.
The event was created in 2017, last year, and it was a 5,470 kilometre solo and unsupported race across Australia from Fremantle, across the Nullarbor Plain, then down to Adelaide, down to Melbourne, from Melbourne up through the Victorian Alps, and then the Kosciuszko National Park of New South Wales, then through Canberra, up through the Southern Highlands of New South Wales, and then finishing outside the Opera House in Sydney.
It's quite a long way. Why would anyone want to cycle that far?
It was a question I asked myself many times as I was riding across Australia. The event itself was created off the back of a largely unrecognised part of Australian history, not just cycling history, of a genre of rider that were known as the Overlanders. And these cyclists were adventurers, pioneers, who in the late 1890s discovered a lot of the interior of Australia, which was then a vastly unknown country. Some would say it still is, but then there was just nothing at all. And they would set off just following camel pad tracks, just sort of trying to just discover what's out there and document what's out there. They took notes later when the cameras came around. They took photographs, but also they had an intrinsic role in actually helping unite or connect, I should say, cities and towns, sometimes gold mines, sometimes far off country properties, and creating, helping to create ostensibly what exists today as the road network around Australia. So these overlanders were really, they were right out at left field type of characters and personalities. And but like I said, the impact that they had on Australia hasn't really been recognised. And then this event was created to recognise that chapter of history, and it was also created to recognise one achievement, Sir Hubert Opperman, who was a great rider, Australian rider that everyone knew from his track days, his Tour de France days. But he was also, I'd say, one of the later overlanders in the 1930s. He did a lot of record rides. In 1937, he rode across Australia, not the same route, but rode across Australia, and this event was trying to honour his achievement, which was then 70 years, I've got my maths right, 70 years of it. So it was really recognising the overlander rider.
So there's an element of adventure and exploration as well as just cycling.
Oh, certainly. It's because the event itself, it's one, it's solo; two, it's unsupported. So you've got to look after yourself. You've got to look, this was the Indian Pacific Wheel Race, or otherwise it became known as the Indy Pack. You have to look after yourself. You can't ride in packs. You can't take outside support. You're not allowed to have. The only things you're allowed to have are access to things that everybody else can have. There is a bit of a grey rule. I know in cycling we talk about grey areas in laws, and there is a large part of this is an honour system as well, so it's your interpretation of what is fair or not. But the event was held in last year, and it had a field of about 70 people. It was very much a question mark as to how it was going to be, unravel. Unfortunately, last year's race ended in tragedy with the death of Mike Hall, the English rider, who was second place overall at the time, and he was just on the southern outskirts of Canberra, about 300 kilometres to go, a little bit more, and there was a collision with a car, and he was killed. And that was on the 14th day of the race. At that time, I was about half a country behind. I'd just arrived into Adelaide, and that's when I heard about the death of Mike, and the organisers cancelled the race. Some people still continued anyway, but they cancelled the race. I stopped at that point. And to this day, the coroner's inquiry into Mike's death still hasn't been held or finished, so we still haven't heard what the outcome of that is.
When you heard that Mike Hall had died, you stopped your event. Was there any thought in your mind about going on in 2017?
No, there wasn't, because it was quite a... I'd actually just sort of got into the groove of the ride at that point. For me, it was about a few hours into my 14th day, and I'd got used to the pain and injuries and everything that comes with endurance riding. And I was arrived at this bike shop in Adelaide called Treadley's, which was then the official bike shop of the race, where all entrants could drop in, they'll get their bike fixed for free, and then you could rest up, shower. It's just like a stopping point. And I was just in there, it was about 9:30 in the morning, my bike was up on the rack, and I was just talking to the mechanic, can you fix my lights, and can you do this and that, and I had some tyre wheel issues. And then somebody who had ridden in with me, one of the we had these people called dot trackers who followed our dots on this GPS system. And she already left. She came back and she said, "Oh, her name is Kay Hasmer." And she said, "Oh, have you heard about the news?" And we said, "No, what? Someone's been killed." And me and the mechanics looked at each other, and obviously we hadn't heard the news. We realised the news then. We realised very quickly, while it hadn't been officially confirmed, that it was Mike who had been killed, because his dot had stopped at that precise point in the news report. My first thought at the time was, because I know how these news stories break, and it would have been Indian Pacific Wheel Race riders being killed in the... been killed this morning, the name hasn't been released. So I immediately thought of my wife Libby and thought, see, I've got to get a hold of her, contact her. And that was my first thought. As these things happened, and I couldn't get a hold of her, and I tried, and text messages, and then she called me. And at that point in time, and this is kind of an important, poignant part of, I guess, the story, obviously, is she was in absolute tears. And because I probably underestimated the inherent fear that she had of worst case scenario of this event. I knew she was concerned, but hearing her tears and everything at that point, I already said, look, I'm coming home. The event hadn't even been officially cancelled then. I said, I'm coming home, don't worry, I'm coming home. And she was, she wasn't telling me, she was sort of like pleading with me to come home. I said, don't worry, it's just a bike ride, I'm coming home. Because there's no way I felt, this is my case, there's no way I felt that I could have you know, it would have been totally selfish, or more unselfish than actually doing the ride, but to expect her to live through the constant angst of following a dot and wondering if it stops, have I been hit by a car, or am I just stopping for a pee? You know, A or B, or a lot in between. And so I went home, and a number of other people went home. So I had no, you know, questions about doing that. And when I got bent back to the bike shop just next door, that's when I got a call from the organiser who said, "Oh, Rupert, just letting you know the race has been officially cancelled." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm not surprised, but I was going to come home anyway." It was a little while before I felt I wanted to do it again. I didn't regret the decision of stopping, and I certainly would never have regret for doing something like that when I realised it's not just about me, it's about my family and friends and people close to me, particularly my wife. So I don't regret stopping, but I did have a little hankering desire or thought of what if I had a finish, because I did go to the finish to see some of the riders finish in Sydney, and I remember going, wow, God, how they must feel now, because I saw their looks on their faces, and I thought, gee, I would love to have done that, you know. But and I thought I'd try and live with that, and then the chance came up to do it again, and my wife wasn't too happy about that at all. It took a lot of stretching of I guess of her patience and support and understanding, and it wasn't all rosy at all. The whole experience, it was a real challenge on, you know, forget the physical side of things and the preparatory side of things. It was a real challenge in learning how to work with your partner or your wife or whatever about understanding, reassuring them. In this case, I had to reassure Libby about safety and security issues, make her feel as confident as possible. And instead of trying to make it an argumentative sort of, I'm going to be fine, I'll be safe, it was more like I said to her, look, instead of us, we don't want this to become arguments. Let's just say, if you have a concern, we just write them down and I'll come back with the answer. So we tick the boxes. So then we both know, and I know, and you know, that I've covered every base possible. Of course, we know in cycling, whether it's an ultra-endurance ride, a Tour de France, or you're just going down to the shops, sadly, we know that you can't cover every base. But you can, I think I learnt out of the tragedy of Mike Hall's experience, I learned a hell of a lot more about a lot of simple things you can do to be safer on the road as a cyclist. A lot of things. One, don't be embarrassed to be wearing garish fluoro kit. Two, ultra endurance riding. I always used to think when I'd see people with a mirror on their bike, if you're going across the Nullarbor Plain or on highways, you want to see what's coming up behind you way before you actually hear them. And I can tell you, with a road train of three or four carriages barreling along at 150 k's an hour, they can't slow down. It's like a ship coming across the ocean. If you're not aware of them passing you, if you're not aware to be able to give them signals that you can see them and they can see you, you know, it's not in their control. You know, it's really up to you to respect their presence. It's their highway, really. I know we talk about sharing the roads, but against a big road train, you've got no chance. So a mirror is really important. And number three, for security and safety, lights, day and night. And not just one light at the back and the front. I had two lights on the back, two on the front, and I even would put one on the helmet at front and a little one on the back as well. And I'll add a fourth. I also had a garment, a jacket, a gilet that's made by a company called Metier. And it's a black garment, but it's got lighting on the front and on the back. You just press a button, and I've saw people said they could see me from miles away in the dark. So lighting is really important. So they're the three things.
Now, 5,700 kilometres. What was your strategy? What was your preparation? First of all, I mean, you've cycled all your life, but I mean, this is another level. So how did you get ready for it? And what was your strategy when you set off?
Well, I had to, because I've done it twice now. The second strategy was, I guess you could say, was the more successful, because I finished it than the first. But then I think that the preparation and the experience from the first helped me get through the second. Because when I didn't finish, I don't look at that as a failure. I said to myself, don't look at it as a failure, because one, there's reasons why you stopped, and two, with this sort of riding, it's more an experience. So it's a win-win anyway. It's a huge, fantastic experience. But for the first race, the Indy Pack race, I probably didn't do as many kilometres as a lot of people, but I did a lot of extra long rides and a lot of nighttime riding. Like I'd get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, but I'd go to a secure park. This is near my place, Centennial Park in Sydney, and it's probably one of the darkest places where it's hidden from the ambient light of the city. So I wanted to get used to riding alone in the dark, with all those creepy, crawly thoughts that go through your mind. Because I was in the city, I remember I used to think, there's probably some mad axeman coming back from a crime or something. He's going to leap out from, how would I respond? But I sort of had to get used to being nervous, because in the desert, particularly in the Nullarbor Plain, you feel really small there. And it is even darker than where I trained in. And you'd see, you know, you'd suddenly be riding along and there'd be a big kangaroo there, for example, or a big red 6'2", you know, with big chest, just like you see in the cartoons. And so you had to get used to that sort of unexpected crossing of a potentially threatening animal. And so I did a lot of those long rides, and I did a couple of overnighters where I'd camp and things like that. But come the second, and my strategy for that race, that first race, I was going to went in with a race mindset, and I was hoping to do 300 kilometres per day. But then I quickly found out every time I did 300 kilometres, I dipped into a hole and would be stuck on, like I'd do like 140 and I'd be busted for a while and then have to build up again. So for the second time, I said, I did less training because I guess I had the foundation of the first year, and I went in there not with a race mentality, just the ride mentality. Just think about finishing, enjoy the experience. And I put my goal of averages to be like 200 kilometres a day. For two reasons. One, it's more realistic. Two, there'll be more chances that I'll do 200 kilometres plus. So there will be more chances of a bit of a win rather than the disappointment of doing less than what you set. And so I did that, and you know, and I got through my average at the end. It was only like 2 days before I actually did the mass, and I actually slowed up towards the end because I was actually enjoying it so much. But my average was 202 kilometres. And my other goal was to finish, you know, 200. I wanted to show you could have a good time doing it. I wanted to show you could also finish in a healthy state. When I did 2000 last year, when I got only halfway, I looked pretty ragged after 2 weeks. And my wife told me that when I finished the event this time in 23 days and in a few hours, I looked better for it, and my body weight actually was only just like half a kilo less than what it was at the start, or my body fat was a lot less, so I finished healthily.
Rafa, adventure starts anywhere.
Thank you very much to Rafa for supporting this series of Explore. Rafa sponsor everything we do all year round, and we're very grateful to them for their support. This week, Richard Moore has even more reason to be grateful, because there's some breaking news, Hannah. After weeks of pestering, he's managed to persuade them to send him an Explore Down jacket. And all this makes me think is, where's my Explore Down jacket?
Well, by the sounds of it, Lionel, you need to start and channel some inner buffalo, and then you might be able to get one.
Well, I'm obviously not going to do that. I'm going to just place the idea out there and see what happens, on the basis that good things come to those who wait. Rafa have an extensive range of clothing and accessories for cyclists who want to go on self-sufficient adventures. The waterproof bar pack provides 20 litres of hassle-free storage with reflective detailing. The hard-wearing fabric combined with welded seams and a double-sided roll closure system make it completely waterproof and ensure the pack keeps its shape while attached to the bike.
I definitely would like one of those.
Are you channeling your inner buffalo here?
I'm just putting it out there and see if good things come to those who wait.
jumping the queue here. What I like about the way the waterproof bar pack looks is that it fits very neatly between the brake levers and just below the handlebars, and that's important to me. You know, if I'm going to laden up my bike with extra weight, I want it to sit nicely and you know, not rock about, and kind of be as inobtrusive as possible, and it certainly looks the part. If you would like a waterproof bar pack or any of the other items in Rafa's range of luggage and handlebar bags and so on, go to rafa.cc.
People do it different ways. Some people decide to, you know, that they say they're going to camp every night, and they did. My approach was just to, if there was a hotel or a motel, it wasn't really hotels, like if there was a roadhouse which had rooms in it, like a motel, I'd use those. And then when I got across the desert, there was a lot more country towns, I thought I'm going to try and stay in the smallest, most local country pub, because I wanted this experience of meeting the locals. And I stayed in some pretty rickety old country pubs, but I remember those days I used to ring ahead and book a room. I used the same line every time, but I probably did mean it, as I'd say, oh, by the way, and by the way, here, I've heard you serve the best coldest beer in the region. And they go, oh, yeah, we do. And I said, well, I'm looking forward to enjoying that. So I'd arrive, and I'd be this sort of stinky body in lycra and looking completely ragged. And then I'd turn up, and then there'd be a beer straight there for me. So I stayed in motels and pubs. I think there was only one night I bivvied on the road. There were times where when, you know, like with sleep patterns, the first year I was doing about 4 hours sleep a night. And this year I gave myself, you know, 5 to 6 hours. Massive difference that does for your recovery. Although there were times that you do get sleepy. And if I did get sleepy, I'd just sort of go off the side of the road and just lay down in a bench somewhere or something like that. So I got quite accustomed to be able to sort of being out there in the wilderness. And that was a great experience. Even overcoming my initial fears of snakes and things creeping, crawlies and things like that.
Well, that was my next question. I just think of the Aussie outback and just worry about all sorts, snakes, spiders, wolves, I mean, wild dogs. I mean, there must be everything out there.
Yeah, yeah. Look, there are. And at the night time, you probably hear more than you actually see. But I remember in the first ride that when we were coming across, I was down near the Great Australian Bite, and there was a couple of others who we left the roadhouse. I think it was Nullarbor Roadhouse at about midnight, and we thought, let's try and, you know, get some good distances before dawn, you know, basically 6 or 7 hours. And we're riding along, and then suddenly I just noticed I started zigzagging a bit, and somebody else who was nearby, and bear in mind, you're not allowed to ride in slipstreams, but you can ride next to each other, you know, and you do see people, you know, like 12 meters ahead and that sort of stuff, and you may come alongside and have a chat. But so I just noticed we were all zigzagging, and so we decided to pull over this is about 1:30 in the morning, to pull over on the side of the road. And I remember my biggest fear before that was snakes, like sleeping there on the ground and snakes just coming in, because it gets quite cold in the desert at night. And I thought maybe the snake would just come up and, you know, creep all over you and into your bivy bag. And this, oh my God, this is going to happen. I'm going to have to do this now. But I remember I pulled out the bivy bag, and I don't even remember putting my head down. And the only thing, I woke up just by the freshness of dawn and the sea air blowing up and over the Australian Bite and waking me up. I didn't even think about the bloody snake. So I think you can overthink things. That's the, you know, you can let your mind grasp the fear of snakes and, you know, as you said, dingoes or dogs and all that. But I think a lot of them are just as scared of you as you may be of them.
So did you see anything that gave you the jitters a bit?
No, like I said, I made mention about this big red kangaroo one night. Again, it was at night, and I stopped for... I just quickly stopped for a pee, and I actually turned all my lights off because I thought I wanted to see how dark it was out here. And I turned my lights off, and it was as dark as if someone put a hand over my eyes. I went, oh gosh, and that's when I felt really small, because I thought, see, with my light, if you look if you're in space, you just see this little red dot and just this massive. It's really the first time I actually had a sense of how big Australia is, even though I couldn't see it. I know you see it if you're in a plane, but I just felt so small. And I thought, my God, if anything happened to me here, I'm completely screwed. And then next thing, I hear this rustle in a bush. And I quickly turn my light back on, and I hear this, and the rustle's coming closer to me. And I was pretty stuffed at that point. And I remember I just sort of leapt on the bike and unleashed what I thought was a Tour de France-style winning bunch sprint. It wouldn't have been a sprint, but then my mind was playing with me a bit, and I remember thinking, gee, maybe this animal's just following on the flank of along me, and maybe there's other animals, whatever it was, on the other side. Maybe they're just waiting until I just tire out, like one of those sort of you know, animal shows, you know, where the pack just chases the weak animal at the back, and I'm that animal, and it's going to wait till I just tire out. And then I got so tired from doing that. After a while, though, I suddenly forgot about the fear of the animals because I just thought, geez, I'm so tired, and then mind just shifted. All your senses change like a light switch, your emotions. You know, you go from fear to the next moment you're thinking, this is the real experience I'll be looking for, you know, this holistic sort of me with nature and solitude. And then you go from this sense of fear, then you go from a sense of panic and then emotionally you get very challenged, from high thoughts, negative thoughts, depressive thoughts. It's like this massive onion of experience, and you just open it up and open each, peel it off, and there's no warning for it. You know, sometimes I'm smiling like I'm in heaven. Well, I'm not saying heaven, I don't know whether heaven exists, but sometimes I'm smiling as if this is the, you know, paradise, and next moment I'd be in tears about some emotion of some memory of something. You know, it totally strips you naked, you know, emotionally, and that's one of the things I wanted to get out of it.
So what did you learn about yourself and also about your country?
Well, first about the country, I found out how beautiful and diverse Australia is. It was really such a great opportunity to get to go and see a country that you live in and probably don't experience enough of, you know, going, you know, the old thing of just going overseas everywhere else but not really appreciating where you come from, and that's why I was very lucky to have the chance to do it twice, let alone once, and to have that time to be able to do it. Whether it helped me, two things that helped me the most was, one, like I spoke to you about the senses, how your senses become much sharper, like your smell, eyesight and hearing, because you are so isolated to it all. But the other sense I got was by, particularly this year when I thought I want to engage with the people I meet, I found a real natural, very a calmness in being able to talk to strangers about anything and people I just meet, and about some very personal stuff as well. I just found like the barriers that we put up around us when we live in cities, because you know, I believe that a lot of people in a city life, they talk but they actually don't communicate, or words come out but they don't actually engage enough with each other. Whereas out in the country, I just felt it's like I just dropped it all and just let it go, and I met some really fantastic people, and it reminded me how country people are really the salt of the earth, and they live a really hard life, but they appreciate the really small things in life as well, and that's helped me sort of appreciate the small things in life, rather than get bogged down in the things I want to have and the, you know, the riches and the wealth and all that sort of stuff. As for myself, I had a lot of issues when I was younger about self-esteem issues and image issues and weight issues. You know, I became bulimic, and it's a condition which doesn't go away. I still deal with it now, you know, but I'm more aware of the triggers of it and the reasons why. So one of the reasons I wanted to do this when I was committed to it was to, like I said, emotionally strip myself bare, but also to deal with, just to try and, I guess, try and get some self-esteem, and to be stripped bare and see how I am in that state and how that affects my issues that I had when I was young, and which continued and still continue today, to be honest. And so when I got to the end, I know a lot of people would say to me, some people said, oh, have you scratched that itch now, you know, you've got it off your back, you've done it, you know, are you all, you know, solved all your problems with that. And one thing I learned was, you know, it doesn't, you still got the same problems, you know, you still got your strengths and you've got your perceived weaknesses. But one thing I did learn out of it was that I'm not going to be ashamed of my weaknesses, I'm not going to be ashamed of my foibles, so long as I'm not hurting someone. But if you do hurt or make a mistake, it's how you respond and move on from it. But that's who I am, is my perceived weaknesses or issues are just as much a part of me as my strengths. So I'm not going to be ashamed of them. I'm just who I am. So it didn't solve all my problems. It just made me become more aware of what they are and to be able to hopefully communicate about them. Because if it can help somebody else sort of be more comfortable in talking about their issues, that can sometimes help them deal with it. And it may, you know, someone may, if people are able to put their issues on the table in public more, or in a forum, answers or solutions can come.
So was it the amount of alone time you had, the amount of time you had to think while doing nothing but pedalling, or was it the sense of the journey you were going on and the question in your mind of, can I make this? I mean, 23 days to be out there cycling 200 kilometres a day, that's a mental challenge as much as a physical one.
Yeah. It very much is. I mean, I found if I thought of the whole 5,500 kilometres, I'd go, oh my God, this is just insane. You know, this is... So, but then usually when I think those things, I was like stuck between nowhere, you know, so I just had to pedal on. And then I learned to not just... Don't think of that whole thing, just think of today. Just think of this morning's ride. And I broke it down into... You know, I started breaking it down into like, oh, this is my ride today. And then as you get tighter, I started to think, well, this is my ride this morning, and then maybe I'll do another ride this afternoon. And just sort of, that helped. So just breaking these things down into smaller parts and just chipping away at them, that helped me get through it a lot, you know. So when I did it this year, I never got to a point where I thought I wasn't going to make it unless I had an injury or something like that. Whereas I think last year I was going across the Nullarbor and still thinking, because the Nullarbor is... There's a lot of vacant space there, and you can start to think, God, this is a big country with this. How am I going to get across there? You know, but this year when I crossed the Nullarbor, because I know it now, I was able to sort of compartmentalise certain sections of it and just mentally just tick them off. But it is an element which, if you overthink it, it can overcome you.
Science in sport. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
You learn a strategy through your training, but it's quite difficult because you wouldn't really go and ride, you know, 3, 4, 5 Grand Tour stages in training. Hi, my name's Hayden Groves. I rode all 3 Grand Tours last year in 2017. Yeah, that's the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France and Vuelta a España, a total distance of just over 10,400 kilometres. Not only did I do that, I'm also an ambassador for Science in Sport. And at the same time, I raised over £100,000 for the charity Cure Leukemia. You have to learn, and it needs to be a common sense approach, that you appreciate that the amount of calorific intake that's required, you know, against maybe on your Garmin or your device will tell you what your calories burned are. I certainly felt that, you know, if I was getting a little bit low on energy, then I'd certainly have a gel as opposed to some real food, because that was going to get straight in. And certainly on a big mountain stage or a really hilly stage, then you burn far more calories than you think you will.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring this series of Explore, and indeed supporting us throughout the whole year here on the Cycling Podcast. It's great to be riding in tandem with Science in Sport, so to speak. Whether you're riding long or short, you need to stay hydrated and full of energy, and Science in Sport's range of product can help you do that. And as a listener, you can get 25% off everything they do by visiting the website scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, enter the code SISCP25. Now it's back to the Tour de France press room in Pau earlier this year, where I sat down with Rupert Guinness to talk about his ride in the Indy Pack in Australia.
And one thing I found funny is, like, you know, the years I've been following cycling and writing about cycling, and now I've just sort of just, it's like I've just opened this door and peeked in and saw another universe in the world of cycling. And then there's a whole, and it's just a completely other new world, and I feel like I've just started. Just, you know, I feel like I'm back at my first Tour de France in 87. It's like going into this new world of bike packing and ultra endurance riding. And so I do start following, you know, when the Trans American race was on recently, I was following people there. And as you said, the Transcontinental race, which Mike Hall, rest his soul, he was the owner and director of it, you know, and his partner Anna is now running it. And you said it was on this weekend. I mean, I was in contact with her, and she was saying, oh, you know, if you want to come up to Gerritsbergen for the start, it would be great. And you know, unfortunately it's clashing with the Tour, you know, so It would have been fantastic to see the start. I would like to do the Transcontinental. I've got see, now I have a bucket list of these things, and I'd like to do that sometime. And one would be great to go back to the race that Mike and now Anna runs, and you know, in respect of him, but also to discover Europe in a pattern like that, just like I've discovered Australia, you know. And I know they've, you know, that race has had, last year someone was killed. But like I said, you can't cover every single base and every single permutation. But I think it's fantastic. And then you've got other events around the world, similar solo unsupported races. Well, one I would like to do, which is supported though, because I'd like to see what the difference is like, is the Race Across America, the RAM. And I'm going to try and qualify for that at an event in Australia, the Revolve 24, which I think they have one in England, the Brands Hatch, and I'm going to. I did that this year just to give it a bit of a go, and I wasn't actually trying to qualify for. I did tick the yes box to qualify, but I didn't really bust a gut, although I was busted at the end. but I was only a bit short of the qualifying mark, so I'd like to give that a crack and see what the difference is between unsupported, solo, ultra endurance bikepacking races and supported, not bike packing, it's just a supported bike race across Australia, solo, so across America, just to see the difference before I make a judgment of what I think is better or not.
An inquest into Michael's death was held in Canberra in September, and evidence into the incident was heard, and the coroner's report is expected early in the new year. Rupert Guinness has written a book about his ride across Australia. It's called Overlander, One Man's Epic Race to Cross Australia. In it, he talks about the aborted ride and then setting off again to cross the country. It's published by Simon & Schuster in Australia, but if you're in the UK or elsewhere, it's certainly available as an ebook, and you may be able to get a physical copy as well. It's called Overlander by Rupert Guinness. Hannah, what did you make of Rupert's story?
It's really incredible, actually, to hear him speak. I mean, I really enjoy listening to Rupert speak about things anyway. I haven't heard him before, but the way he describes how the race is in homage to the Overlanders and how much of an influence and impact they had on Australia and the networks of discovering it by bike. And you kind of think that back in the 1890s when they were doing it, like to start and discover Australia by bike at that time would be really crazy. So you can then see why the race actually wants to honour them and what they've done and how they helped map Australia. And also you can imagine there's quite a lot of it that's not changed from when they were riding across it back then, especially in some of the real deep outback. So yeah, so that was really an interesting part of it for me. The other thing that I think I found really interesting to hear him talk about was things about using the mirrors on your bike and the fluoro gear and everything like that to try and make you as safe as possible in the lights. But that still doesn't really protect you from the animals. And I think that I would freak out about. The thought of spiders in a bivy bag actually makes my skin crawl.
Well, that's one of the things that terrifies me. I mean, as you know, I'm frightened of almost everything. And when Rupert was talking about his ride across the outback, I just had this kind of almost computer game style image of snakes and spiders and kangaroos and koala bears. I mean, koala bears aren't scary, are they? But they're all jumping out on him as he rode through. And that must have been quite a consideration for him. In fact, it was a consideration for him. It makes me think of the TV show, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Rupert was doing his own version of I'm a Cyclist, Get Me Out of Here. But I love the fact that he rang ahead to all of the hostelries and bars to announce that he was coming and buttered them up with, I hear you serve the best, coldest beer. I'll be arriving in an hour and a half or whatever. That's so Rupert. He's such a people person. It's a tactic I might try on the Tour de France. We'll ring ahead and announce our arrival and see if we can't get ourselves a bit more of a gold standard welcome.
I think if you're going to arrive after 9 p.m., it's not going to help you anything.
That's true. That is true.
But also what Rupert was doing about riding in the middle of the night and practicing beforehand and just, yeah, and it, darkness makes you even more scared about meeting animals in the middle of the night, even if it is a koala, I think, but yeah.
Well, before we move on, it's over to producer Tom in his shed, Tom Wally's shed. He's going to run through a list of the handful of top events he'd like to have a go at.
Thanks, Lionel. Yeah, I'm currently actually half inside and half outside the shed. That's because I'm currently in the process of cleaning my bike. In homage to those great overlanders and explorers, I went on a bike ride myself this afternoon that involved a few adventurous off-road sections and some gravel. Now, within about a few metres of that first sector of gravel, I'd already got a puncture. As this series is often about unsupported rides, I did actually change that puncture myself. Getting into the spirit of things. Now, on this series, we've already talked about the Transcontinental Race. Two-time winner James Hayden, he was on last week's episode. If you haven't heard it, please check it out. And listening to Rupert talk about the Indy Pack, the Indian Pacific Wheel Race, got me thinking about the sort of races that I, or rides, or just journeys that I might like to take part in. And it's a world that is absolutely massive. You know, these are the headline sort of rides, but there are so many more that you can do. So Rupert, for instance, Rupert also talked about doing the Race Across America. Now, that is one of the events that I myself would most like to do. It's the sort of bucket list event. And that's mainly for me because it's supported, meaning that you don't need to carry any of your belongings or fix your own bike if it goes wrong. Now, another race that's on my list is a real heritage event, and that's PBP, Paris-Brest-Paris. And it's a bit of an exception to the type of event we've covered so far, in that its origins are as a professional race. In its current guise, it takes place every 4 years, and the next one, conveniently, that's in 2019. Now, it's a randonneuring event, meaning that you have to get a brevet card stamped at set locations along the route. Now, if you're at all interested in riding PPP in 2019, the advice would be to ride the longest possible BRM or RN events, their randonneuring series events, in the 2018 season. But that ended on the 31st of October this year. So if you've not already qualified, you're probably out of luck. One great resource for this kind of riding, and it's where I've been visiting quite a lot recently, is the website ridefar.info. And on there, there's an index of a huge amount of these type of rides, of races. From my own perspective, just perusing that website, a couple of rides that have really caught my imagination include the Iberica Traversa. Now, this is a ride which crosses Spain, but it uses unpaved roads and trails. It's 1900 kilometers, although a 1200 kilometer version is available. Easy. Another one that really appeals to me is the Tour Divide. Now, this is a race along the Rocky Mountains, starting in Canada, through the USA to the Mexican border. I'm not even going to do any satire about that. It's a mountain bike event and it's 4,400 kilometres. I imagine that's absolutely beautiful. Now, another one that's it's been on my bucket list since I came across it is the Simpson Desert Bike Challenge. Now, that crosses the Simpson Desert in Australia, going from west to east, and it consists of around 9 or 10 timed stages over 5 days. That's because you do 2 stages each day. It covers only around 485 to 570 kilometres, but then when you think about the course, which traverses around 700 sand dunes, goes across salt lakes and past vast cattle stations, you can understand that, you know, the short distance isn't what makes it that difficult. If you do want to do it, you're going to need a support crew who are comfortable driving four-wheel drive vehicles through sand, and it'd be their job basically to keep you alive. And given they've just talked about their love of all things Australian creepy crawly, I thought for next year I'd sign up Hannah and Lionel.
Thanks for that, Tom. The Indy Pack and the other events that Tom talked about there are races. People are trying to get from A to B as quickly as they can, which is pretty much the opposite of what our next guest was trying to do. Ollie Broom gave up his job in the city in 2009 and decided that he wanted to cycle to Australia in time to watch the first test of the Ashes cricket series. It took him 14 months. 412 days to be precise, and he wrote a book about his journey too. It's called Cycling to the Ashes, a cricketing odyssey from London to Brisbane. And off the back of his adventure, he set up the Slow Cyclist, which is an adventure travel company. And they run trips to Transylvania in Romania, Greece, Tuscany, and Rwanda. And, well, it's always, you know, you're mocking me, Hannah, for cycling slowly. But I think it's a very pleasurable way to see the world on two wheels.
Yes, and I do, and it is mocking, it really is, because I
know.
it's done in the best possible kind of a nice way of mocking. It's not, I'm not being serious. But what I totally agree with the fact of that people always want to try and do rides, or some people want to try and do rides and how quick they can do it. But I, from my own experience, I've ridden London to Paris twice now. Actually, the second time didn't quite make it, but that's another story. But and the first time I did it, we took 3 to 4 days, and then the second time we did it in 24 hours. And by far, absolutely hands down, the 3.5 days that we took to do it the first time was such a nicer experience, just because you get to see so much more and actually take in what is going on around you, rather than cycling in the night feeling tired and being grumpy.
Being grumpy? No, never, never. I want to hear about this failed trip from London to Paris at some point. Maybe that will be all will become clear later in the series. But for now, let's hear from Ollie Broom about his great adventure.
It was a love of cricket and cycling. I found myself working in London, doing a job that I sort of liked but didn't love, and I used to spend, shamefully, quite a lot of time on the internet looking up ideas for travel. And my old man had driven from London to Cape Town in the 70s, and I'd always wanted to do that, but it occurred to me that actually I might be able to go one better, and I might be able to go somewhere a long way away under my own steam. It had always appealed, and so at one point in about mid-2009, I told my boss I was leaving. When I told him what I was leaving to do, he thought I was mad, and I quit my job as a chartered surveyor in London, and about 6 weeks later headed off from beneath the media centre at Lord's Cricket Ground and headed off to the Brisbane Cricket Ground. It took me 14 months to get there, but it was well worth it. I was not a cyclist. In fact, I'd hardly describe myself as a cyclist now, but I was definitely not a cyclist before I went. I'd done a London to Paris about 9 months earlier, when the sort of the idea of cycling a very long way to Australia had first come about. So I'd done London to Paris. It took me 8 days, an awful long time, as anyone who's done that journey will know. And on the night before I left for Australia, I remember my bike arrived the day before that, so 2 days before I left, and I hooked up my panniers on the front and back for the first time and weaved my way along the road outside my parents' house with the panniers full, and I lost my balance and fell over. I mean, that's how much of a long distance cyclist I was. I wasn't very wasn't very professional effort, the whole thing, really. But I got there, and you know, in the end, and so it all paid off. There was definitely a sense of setting off and seeing how I go. At the end of my first day on the bike, I was in tears because I was in so much pain. My knee was so painful. Luckily I was with about 15 friends who cycled down from London towards the south coast. We camped somewhere in Kent, and this doctor friend of mine said, "Don't worry, not all pain is bad," and that set me right. And my knee improved over the next couple of weeks. A couple of weeks in, I knew I would make it physically. I knew that physically that wasn't the challenge. It was going to be mentally, you know, a mental challenge more than anything else, and it turned out to be just that. As I got on the ferry, my thought was, I'm going to follow the little blue lines on the maps as much as I can, because rivers tend to be pretty flat, and the land next to the rivers tend to be pretty flat. So that's what I did through Europe. I followed rivers like the Altmühl and the Mosel, which are all tributaries of the Rhine, and then onto the Danube. And I cycled along the Danube, you know, all the way. Where was it to Serbia, and then left it as I entered Bulgaria. So all through Europe, I had, you know, very flat land, trying to get myself fit, doing, you know, 50, 60 kilometers a day at the start and building up towards 100, which tended to be my aim throughout the trip, trying to cycle 100 kilometers a day. And then But day to day, just sort of plotted my route as I went. Really, I wasn't a big fan of, plotting weeks and weeks ahead, or certainly not before I left on the trip. No, it was much more ad hoc than that. I played quite a few proper games of cricket. The highlight being playing at the MCG with Merv Hughes bowling at me. But they range from that down to playing with a few Iraqi refugees in a Damascus rubbish dump. Playing in the Nubian desert on the border with Egypt with some guys in jalabiyas who'd never seen or heard of cricket before. So it was lots of silly games, but also, games with the Serbian, the Hungarian, the Turkish national teams. You know, cricket can be found everywhere, and it was a delight to find it, because, cricket was a big part of my ride to Australia. I was obviously cycling out to watch the Ashes. And to find cricket and to have that common ground with so many people, common love with so many people around the world, this great, great game, it was fantastic. The Serbians in particular, their love of cricket is, not Serbians in general, but the chaps I met, so Vladimir and Slobodan and all these guys who've been playing cricket for so long now in Serbia so passionately, to see their passion for it was fantastic. One thing that used to scare me a little bit, actually, was in a country that's not that dissimilar to the UK. Well, it's dissimilar in terms of geographically, Australia, culturally pretty similar. But I used to camp quite a lot in the middle of nowhere. And they'd be in, you'd be in a sort of outback car park. It was a designated campsite, but it might be 500 miles from somewhere. And I'd be asleep. And at about 3 a.m. or something like that, some fishermen would turn up. Pissed as parrots, and they'd sort of sit quite close to me, getting even more drunk for about 3 hours, and then would leave the following morning. And I never quite knew. I mean, you hear all the, I don't know if you've seen Wolf Creek, but films like that and stories like that in the middle of the outback sort of preyed on my mind a bit. So it wasn't particularly nice camping on your own 500 miles from anywhere with a bunch of pissed Aussies nearby. But otherwise, I don't know, really, nothing particularly. I mean, I got hit a couple of times by, wing mirrors, and once by a passing lorry just sort of clipped me, and I fell off a little bridge in Bulgaria, which wasn't particularly nice. It was some more of those practical fears rather than existential, existential ones. The outback was fantastic for cycling across. There was one episode when I was cycling across the Barclay, a remote part of the Barclay Tablelands, and I was pushing my bike quite a lot through sand and that kind of thing. I was actually on my bike at this moment, and a truck came up behind me. It was a big sort of mining area, and three blokes were in the front of the truck, and it was a flatbed, and the driver sort of reached across his mates and just looked at me and went, "You fucking stupid bastard." And this is like an outback welcome. I thought it was fantastic. And he just jumped out of his truck, jumped onto on his flatbed, where there was a fridge that was tied down to the flatbed. And he grabbed there's a freezer section of the fridge, grabbed a frozen bottle of water and just hurled it at me as hard as he could. And then they drove off. And I thought that was, fantastic outback hospitality. The next day, they came back, traveling the opposite direction. And he didn't say a word, this time just gently. Got out of the car and went into his freezer and passed me without hurling it at me as hard as he could, just passed me a frozen bottle of water and said good day and went on his way. That was outback hospitality for you. It was a good memory. If you think about the places I was at certain times of year, it always differed. So for example, in Serbia there was only about 8 hours of light at the time of year I was there, towards the end of the year, November. So I'd get up, when it got light. So I'd probably be up and on the road by 8:30, 9 o'clock after cooking myself some breakfast. I had a little camp stove I used to cook breakfast on. I'd cycle. And again, this point, I wasn't, still wasn't particularly fit, despite having been on the road for a month or so. So would cycle, stop for lunch in a village somewhere. Probably cook myself some lunch and then cycle in the afternoon. And by about 3 o'clock, So in other words, you've been cycling for, you know, 5 or 6 hours. By about 3 o'clock, you're beginning to look for somewhere to sleep, because you really don't want to get stuck just before dark with nowhere to sleep. So you'd in Serbia and that part of Europe, I'd be trying to look for somewhere really early. In the outback, I used to get quite a few more kilometres done if the wind was in my favour, which generally it wasn't. Some days I'd cycle for half a day if I just wanted to do 100 kilometres in the day, and I could do it downwind, I could do it in 4 or 5 hours. But if it was a headwind, you know, I'd only be able to manage 50 kilometres in a day, because I'd be travelling at 5 kilometres a day. So the routine was very much like, try to get 100 kilometres done, see where I am. If I fancy sleeping there, just sleep there. Otherwise, there are certain countries I used to like getting to settlements. So Turkey, for example, didn't really want to camp out in the middle of nowhere. Quite a few wild dogs, didn't particularly enjoy those. So I used to like getting to settlements. So sometimes that meant doing a 70 kilometre day and staying in a cheap hotel or something. And sometimes that meant doing 120, 130 kilometres a day and getting in after dark. So it really, you know, in a way there was routine, but in a way there wasn't. Every day was a bit different. And that was sort of part of the thing that I say about solitude and loneliness. You know, every day was different, and every day I met new people. Constantly having conversations with roadside with drivers on the roadside. You know, people asking what I was doing, and I might have an hour long conversation with someone who's not in a hurry, and they're just passing, and they see this strange man cycling his bike. You know, people have time in a lot of the world to stop for a chat. The question I get asked most often, I was in Rwanda doing a bike ride last week. I was asked it by a couple of people I was cycling with. You know, did you have any scary moments, or, you know, what were people nasty to you? You know, all that kind of thing. Were you held at gunpoint? You know, never. I mean, people were just without about two or three exceptions through 14 months on the road. People were just wonderful. You know, incredibly kind. Almost the more alien, the more foreign somewhere is, and the more out of place you look, the kinder people were. And I just found that astonishing, and that's something that, you know, I would take with me throughout life, really. I learned that I was quite a lot tougher than I thought I was. and also that I was able to compartmentalise my thoughts quite well. You know, my if I was scared or worried, I'd sort of put it to the side and just crack on. Like, I learned that. I learned not to be worried about too much stuff, and I had this goal of getting to Brisbane. You just got to focus on it, and there was nothing you could do. You know, if there was a headwind of 50 miles an hour going across the outback, to travel at 4 kilometres an hour was just what you had to do. So I learned to deal with that. And if you told me before I left that I'd be cycling across the outback at about 4 or 5 kilometres an hour for days on end, I probably would never have left. So I think it's, I probably learned to jump into stuff like that without too much thought, actually, and just take risks. It was the weeks on my own that I got the most out of. You know, if I look back 8 years later now, you know, I really enjoyed the 2 weeks where my friend James came out and cycled through 4 European countries with me. It was great fun, but I didn't get to meet an awful lot of other people. It was when I was on my own that I was sort of forced into situations where I would meet other people, and of course, you know, that's always pretty interesting. I was in touch with people, but this was relatively early days of sort of Facebook, and Twitter certainly was new. So I was doing Facebook posts, I was blogging, but probably only about twice a month. I wasn't really in touch with friends, like speaking to them. I was in touch with my family. When I got to a big city, I'd probably call them. But when I felt like I'd let go properly when I got out of Europe. You know, crossing the border from Bulgaria into Turkey was a big moment, because I'd never been to a predominantly Islamic country before. And Bulgaria, I'd found a bit, what's the word? There wasn't an awful lot going on there. There was an awful lot of people, but it seemed pretty downtrodden. I crossed the border from, I can't remember the name of the Bulgarian town, but into Turkey, and the town there was the old capital, Edirne, and, you know, seeing the minarets above Edirne, and then cycling into the town just before dark, and there was activity everywhere. I could not believe how busy it was. You got a sense of like, wow, okay, this is why the Ottoman Empire was so successful. These people are industrious. They are working really hard. I mean, the place was buzzing. And that suddenly made me feel like I was somewhere very, very different and very exciting. And to be honest, it was an awful lot of those Islamic countries that were my favourites on the trip. You know, Turkey, Syria, Sudan, Bangladesh. These places were fantastic places to cycle across. And the hospitality you were on the receiving end of was just phenomenal.
Now, you got to Brisbane the day before the first test of the Ashes. Just remind us how they got on in that first test at the Gabba.
In the first test at the Gabba, I can't quite remember what happened in the first innings, but I remember how the test match finished, because Alistair Cook got a double 100, Jonathan Trott got 100, and Andrew Strauss got 100, and I think we were something like 600 for 2 declared, and we saved the match. And then of course we went on to win the series 3-1. It was one of the greatest Ashes series, if you're an Englishman, away from home in history, and I managed to see pretty much every ball, so I felt extremely lucky. And of course, you know, I put it all down to my bike ride and shaking Andrew Strauss's hand the day before the Ashes started. Nothing to do with it whatsoever, but it was great to be there. Yeah. It did inspire a career change. I got back, didn't want to do what I was doing before, and I actually spent a couple of years after my trip living and working in Rwanda, and I was building a cricket ground there, and one of the things I used to do at weekends was head off and explore the place by bike. Completely fell in love with it. I just thought, other people have got to see this place. It's absolutely beautiful. I mean, just one of the most beautiful places in the world, and incredibly friendly people. You know, it's obviously got a troubled history, but it's you know, it's on the way up now. And then I returned home after that in late 2013, and thought, right, I want to take people cycling, and I'd love to take people to Rwanda, but I'm not sure it's commercially viable to survive. You know, new wife, new family. I needed to support. Not sure it's commercially viable to do that. So I just began thinking about other places I wanted to, you know, I thought I could take people cycling. And we started with Romania, and, you know, we still do that. It's been really, really good for us. And I take people to Rwanda. I was there last week, and you know, we take people to other places in Europe. But the idea is that I wanted to provide something accessible that, you know, people who didn't consider themselves cyclists or don't consider themselves cyclists would look at our website, look at our company, and say, "Oh, actually, that sounds cool. You know, I can go on a trip like that." You know, it's not about speed; it's about traveling. Actually, you know, we describe our guests as curious travelers with a bit of juice in their legs. You know, they've got a bit of energy; they just want to see a place and they don't want to be in a car. You know, and actually a bike is a wonderful way to see a place. You know, a lot of our trips are a mix of cycling and walking, and that's just a magic, you know, magic combination for seeing the best of a place.
My interview with Ollie Broom came about in quite a circuitous route, Hannah.
Really? How was that?
Well, a couple of months ago, the Conservative Party tweeted something on a Sunday afternoon that really got my blood pressure rising. It was a picture of some cyclists on a segregated cycle lane, and the heading was, "We're clamping down on dangerous cycling." It annoyed me really, because I think when it comes to road safety, there's quite a lot to clamp down on before we get to issues regarding cyclists. Cyclists are a vulnerable road user in a way. Rather than just kind of express my irritation on Twitter, I decided to write to my MP, who is a Conservative. His name is Bim Afolami, and I wrote what I hope was a constructive email, inviting him to come for a bike ride on the roads of his constituency to see some of the, you know, some of the ways that, you know, the challenges that we have on the roads, you know, close passes and difficult junctions and all of that kind of thing. And I must admit, I wasn't really expecting the response that I eventually got, which was an invitation to go and meet him and talk about cycling. It turned out that Bim Afolami, Conservative Member of Parliament for
not Watford,
a different constituency, turned out he's very much in favour of cycling. He cycles himself, and in the new year, he's going to take me up on my invitation to go for a bike ride, and we'll probably go quite slowly and have a nice coffee somewhere. But in the course of our conversation, he explained that Ollie Broom is his brother-in-law, and the name rang a bell because I remembered the book when it came out, and so he put me in touch, and that's how it happened. So appropriately for the slow cyclist, we arrived at this interview via a circuitous route.
Excellent. So absolutely seamless.
Well, it was. What did you make of Ollie Broom's story? And does the idea of cycling, well, to the other side of the world in 14 months, it's quite mind-boggling.
I mean, to say that he'd not really been on a bike or done that much cycling prior to this trip, that is definitely setting the bar high. For him to then to have pulled that off, and also to have been on the road for that many months straight off the back of giving up his job and everything was, it's really an incredible story. I think the bit that I really liked that he was talking about was about being in the Australian outback and getting that guy lobbing a bottle of water at him out of the back of his truck. I was thinking about, I was speaking to someone else in a later issue, the episode that's going to come up, about road angels. And I was like, I'm not sure whether that qualifies as road angels. But anyway, very helpful of him.
Road angels are people who come to a cyclist's rescue or meet their needs at their hour of need, I guess. All I could think of was it was just another thing to add to Rupert's list of outback worries. The spiders and snakes, and then motorists chucking full water bottles at him.
Yeah, being taken out by a torpedoing water bottle is probably not the way he'd like to have gone out of doing his ride across Australia, I can imagine.
Absolutely. Well, Hannah, that's just about it for episode 2 of Explore. Have you been keeping an eye on the reaction out there in the real world to episode 1?
Yeah, actually, we've had some really lovely feedback, which has been nice to hear, obviously, because it's something that's been quite different to what usually do on the cycling podcast. But it's obviously an area of cycling that we're seeing that's really sort of starting to take shape, and a lot of people are enjoying that kind of exploration. So it's been nice to actually speak to people about it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that feedback goes as the series goes on, because each episode is quite different, looking at, you know, telling different stories, looking at different aspects of cycling. We've had a lot of suggestions for a subsequent series. Well, I mean, the full intention is to do series 2 in 2019. We're full up for this series, but if you do have an idea for something you think we should look at in the next series of Explore, let us know. You can send us a tweet at cycling_podcast, or send us an email, which is better because then I can collate them all together and we can come up with a feature list for series 2. And our email address is contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. It would be great to hear from anyone who's got an idea of something we should cover. But that's it for episode 2. We'll be back with episode 3. So until next time, thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Lionel.
Next time on Explore.
I came down the hill into Berrydale Village, and I just looked on Google Earth or whatever, and the bend, and I knew where it was, and we talked about how the support crew were going to be by the roadside. And Helen was right in the village, and I shouted out to her, "Is this Berrydale?" And she, I can't remember what she said. Yeah, it is, and you're going to do this. And my aunt and uncle were on the switchback bend, just cheering like mad. And then my friends were just running alongside, but the intensity of that spectacle was incredible. And to be, I remember thinking, I mean, I must have gone up that climb, I don't know, because 400 watts, who knows? It was just, I was climbing as well as I've ever climbed, and I'd been on the bike for so long. And at that moment, I was just thinking, you know, this is me right here with my friends and my family climbing this iconic climb. And I'm going to break this record. And it's amazing.
You have been listening to Explore by The Cycling Podcast. The producer was Tom Wally. Music in this episode, including our opening theme, Beyond the Black Veil, is by Moscow Youth Cult. Their latest album, Brutalist, is out now on Hello Thor Records. You can find it via hellothor.bandcamp.com. This episode also featured additional music by John Dix.